Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guests, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Gina Close with us, the author of What's Your Magical Moment? Disconnect to Reconnect with Real Life. Gina is an inspired entrepreneur, an author. She's a corporate leader and a peak performance leadership educator. Also a coach as well as a wife, a mother, and an artist. With over 30 years of experience, she's successfully educated and coached thousands of people on a wide range of life challenges related to health, relationships, family, to wealth, careers, business, and is a Vedic master and a certified instructor at the Chopra Center, founded by Deepak Chopra. Gina teaches meditation, yoga, and wellness. She also leads young entrepreneurs and leaders to tomorrow as an instructor for Draper University of Heroes, and that was founded by Tim Draper. Is a featured instructor on the ABC Family Startup You reality show. In addition, she's been a lead facilitator for the Anthony Robbins Foundation Making Strides program. Her new book, again, What's Your Magical Moment, reminds people that amidst our hectic, fast-paced, demanding day-to-day magical life, our lives, there is magic moments where we find our true meaning of life. And Gina, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me today, Michael.
And by the way, the first question is, what do you do in your spare time?
I know. Oh, well, I live my magical moments. Do my best. Yes.
Oh, yeah. No, I hear you loud and clear. You know, we all have those magical moments, but I think what happens is we need people like yourself to remind us that they're there. We go through this very fast-paced, microwavable world, and we forget that those magic moments are there, and sometimes we need to be reminded to slow down and take a look at what's there.
Well, I agree. You know, as we all know, time passes so quickly, and our life's moments are lost in a whirlwind of to-do lists and tasks and work, and oftentimes we find ourselves feeling a little bit empty in our heart and our life because society teaches us that to be happy, we have to do more, be more, and have more. And my feeling is, what are we working so hard for anyway? Time with our family,
yeah.
Time with ourselves, fun, and peace. Why wait? Let's do it now.
Yeah, but that's really interesting. We talk about a magical moment, and I think satisfaction is a great word. You know, there are so many people who are into, you know, joy and love and rapture and all this good stuff, where joy to some people can mean absolute pain because every time they get joyful, somebody knocks them down. Satisfaction is a very powerful word because it puts everybody can throw their meaning on it. And I think when we're dealing with a magical moment, it's really to define it in such a way that that person that's experiencing it actually recognizes it. So in your world, what is a magical moment?
Well, in my world, a magical moment's a moment in time where we really pause and experience our life disconnected from the distractions of life and cell phones and computers and really take time to evaluate our real life experience, whether it's a joyful moment or a challenging moment, inspiring or sad, and asking yourself, what does this moment mean for me? And that will be different for everyone. Everyone has a different meaning for an experience. And it's really pausing. The magic comes from saying, what's inspiring? What's the lesson? What's the gift? And sometimes we may not know the gift or the lesson until long after the moment's happened. But it's what makes up our life and the story of our life.
Oh, sure. And a gift can be someone passing away. A gift can be losing everything you have. A gift can be a divorce. Not at the time. That's traumatic. But afterwards, what came out of it, what you experienced about yourself and the growth from it. So that, in essence, can be that magical moment when you recognize there's more to you than you thought there was.
Well, and you know, it's funny because it's not funny, but it was tragic this last weekend ago. A dear friend of mine lost their son in a tragic boating accident off the coast of Catalina, and they came to our home for the week. And in dealing with all of the to-dos and answering the questions and all of that, we paused. We went to the beach, at sunset and just left everything at the house, and they were together as a family with their other kids and able to really pause and feel each other, feel the sunset, and come together as a family. And the magic in that moment was realizing that love transcends life. And they were able to have that
powerful.
In their grief and tragedy. And it's really taking the pause. And it doesn't have to be in the challenging moment. It can be in fun moments as well. But it's that pause from our virtual world and all the distractions and the pressure to do more that we have real life.
Oh, sure. And then the other kids that were left, the ones that that made it through and didn't pass away, look at what they got. They finally realized that they were absolutely loved, even if they thought they were before, that bonding probably would never have been the same if that situation hadn't occurred.
Absolutely. And it was just sort of listening to the ocean and being in nature and connecting us to the real world, where they just hugged and they were able to cry, and then they were able to celebrate their son's life, that moment brought them together, and they just felt love swirling and within them. And it was an honor to witness that and to be part of that. And that's just a moment. And we all have moments every day. Every single one of us has a moment. Just ask the question, what's a magical moment in my life? It redirects our focus. You know, where focus goes,
absolutely.
Energy flows. Yeah. Yeah, it's important.
No question about it. And I think one of the biggest challenges to the magical moments, and you have it here, it's technology. Man, from the minute somebody gets up to the minute they go to bed, they're at that computer. I'm an old gym rat. I don't know what it's like not to go to the gym. And I remember the old days, people were talking, laughing, screaming, yelling, and grunting. Today, it's dead silence in that gym. They've got their earphones on, and you can't talk to anybody because they don't hear you.
Well, yeah, you know, everywhere you turn, people are on cell phones and texting, doing selfies, emailing, and people rarely look up anymore. You know, our technology, while it's an important tool, and I would never say that you should never be on, but there's balance, it's invading our sacred time, our family dinners, our vacations, even our time alone with our own thoughts. And recently I've been noticing that parents are giving their babies and their toddlers phones and tablets to comfort them.
Oh, boy.
Well, and it's what will happen is every experience leaves a biological imprint on our bodies and our minds. And so those babies are bonding with technology rather than their mother's touch or their sounds of their voice or looking into their eyes. And for me, it's pretty scary. Pretty scary.
Sure. That's two of us. Okay. Now, is there a certain time of day, time at night, when it's best to do this?
Well, I don't, you know, really any time. I mean, the truth is it can be simple. It can be even right now for your listeners or people in their cars or in homes, just pause and ask yourself what's your magical moment. I mean, even going to bed at night, it's nice to take a moment to put down your cell phone and really reflect on your day and ask yourself what was magical about this day. Because, you know, tomorrow's not promised to anyone, as we all know and read in the paper. And often we don't realize the value of our time until, you know, we look back on our lives and we don't usually say, gee, I wish I spent more time on my cell phone or posting to social media. It's really being with the people that we love. So whether it's waking up in the morning and asking what has to happen so that I can have a magical moment today, or going to bed at night and reflecting on what was the magic in my life today, it's helping to remember that balance between the demands of life and life.
Okay, I'm that person out there that never realized that there was a magical moment. What do I do to get my foot on the path? What do I do to start to find it?
Okay, well, here's a simple answer. My book takes you on a path for doing that, but here's the simple answer. Start by realizing you have magical moments every day and every moment. There's magic there for every person out there. And then ask yourself the question, what's a magical moment in my life? And then the next step would be to ask the people around you, what's a magical moment in your life? You learn so much about people by asking them, what's a magical moment in your life? We, if you come to dinner at our house, and I hope sometime you will, we share magical moments. And I remember a specific dinner where we went around the table, and there was a young man on my son's basketball team, and it was his turn, and he was last, and he stayed quiet for the whole dinner. And we said, okay, Austin, what's your magical moment? And he said, well, my magical moment was last week when I picked my father up from the airport after his tour of duty in Afghanistan. My magic was that my dad was alive, because many of his friends aren't, and my dad is magic in my life. And we all paused, because we would never have known that moment and what he was thinking had we not asked it. You know, and so you learn a lot about the people in your life, your children. Another mother shared with me once,
My son said his magical moment was that he wasn't getting bullied anymore at school. What? What? What is that?
That's magical.
Well, that is magical, and you learn. You learn what goes on. My kids have been sharing magical moments since they've been little, and you see, you know, the transitions in life, the next stages they go into, and really what's magical to them. So it's important to just start asking the question. Simply ask the question.
1993, I had a magical moment. My mom passed away, and my brother had been living with her, and then we went to the memorial, and then my brother came back to the house with us. So I'm in the kitchen, and a light bulb went out. And I had to get up to get it, and there was those things that are in the middle of the kitchen? Susie, help.
What
are
island.
Island. Like thank you. Sometimes island, yeah. I need words. There's the island, and then there's a big chair, and it was one of those, not just a regular chair, but it was a high chair. So I stood up on it, and I got up on the island, and I didn't realize that I had never bolted the island down, and it started coming back on me, and I fell backwards. And about 2 inches from the ground, the fall stopped, and I gently got put on the ground, and she was there. I mean, she had to be there. Otherwise, who knows what would have happened to me. But about 2 inches from the ground, it just slowed down. Yeah. So I had a magical moment.
So let me ask you, let's take it one step further then. What does that magical moment mean for your life?
That she's still here.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. It's really finding the magical meaning that love and care and support transcends life. If you just pause to find the magical moment and then ask yourself, what does it mean? You know, many of us go through life with really tragic experiences or challenges, and we feel resentful and angry. And if we just were to take a moment and ask, what else could this mean? You know, our thoughts aren't facts. Our thoughts are just thoughts. So really asking, what does this mean? If you could find a more nourishing meaning or a gift that turned you into who you are today, you know, you feel the love of your mom. So many of us feel that, you know, so it's just pausing to ask the question to our children and know that it's where we can find meaning. Sometimes in the hustle bustle of our hectic life, our hearts and our lives feel empty, just feel empty, and we're searching. And so we distract ourselves with more technology, more social media, more TV, more, and yet really pausing to be with our own thoughts is an art, and it's so important to life. So important.
Oh, you know, we're anticipating, you know, it's either 2 weeks ahead or a week and a half or 3 months behind, and most people do not live in the present time. What's going to happen in 3 weeks? I'm working towards that. Oh, what happened to me then, and yada, yada, blame somebody about something. And it's really taking that moment in time just to be there. And I would venture to guess most people just don't know how to be there.
Well, that's exactly right. I remember there's a story in my book, and there's a lot of stories from many people all over the world, but one in particular, this guy's a football coach and a jock and a golfer, and he called me one day. He said, Gene, I have a magical moment. I said, go. And he said, well, I left my phone in the car. I walked into the movie theater, and I went and watched a kid's movie, the Lego movie. I bought popcorn. I bought a soda, and I was totally immersed in the laughter of the children and the fun. And he goes, I had the best time ever. It was such magic. It brought me back to the fun I used to have as a child, and I'm going to go more often. It's just pausing. It can be something as simple as that.
Here's a magical moment, and this was you have to go back with it. I know a woman who, when she was in college, she wanted to be a professional athlete. So she talked to her coach, and he said, you don't have what it takes. I wouldn't even waste my time if I were you. But she wouldn't listen to him. She went out and she found a coach. He trained her, and she became a professional athlete and then ended up to be an adjunct professor of athletics at a university. Okay, let's go back now. The coach that she found, they ended up falling in love. They've been married for 20 years now. But
oh,
the point
gosh.
Of contention was the magical moment was when they met. Otherwise, they would have never met, so my recommendation to her was send the coach, the original coach, send him some flowers and say thank you.
Well, it's true, and at that moment, she probably felt devastation, and yet you want to send a thank you note because it empowers you to do more. It empowers you to have more. You know, I think
absolutely.
There are people in our lives as we grow and as we learn, there are people in our lives that touch us, that have shifted our lives, and many of them don't even know it. And, you know, one of the things I advocate in one of the chapters in my book is just take a moment's pause and remember those people. send them a note saying, you never knew this, but you really had a great impact on my life. And that's for the negative people, too, the people that we find most challenges with, you know, the people that are that have hurt us, maybe, the people that have tested us. Those people could be our greatest heroes because they shaped us.
Oh, sure.
And really find the magic in those people, too. That's the great challenge. It's really easy to say I'm wonderful, I live life with integrity, I live life with joy when life is easy. But life will test you and give you those challenges and those tough times. Will you really find the magic and be that person in those moments? And that's a magical moment when you can do that.
Yeah, and then the people who are doing that, you created in the first place.
Well, that's right. I mean, you know, they're your worthy opponent. They're your worthy opponent. And they show up so that you can really show who you really are in life. You know, they're the people that are worthy.
Yeah. And the life in and of itself is nothing more than a big mirror. So what you have around you is what you created. And every step of the road in life is a lesson. And it's just going through the stuff and looking at it close enough to learn the lesson.
Well, that's
right.
And I think that and we're role models. Like, there's a lot of stories in my book about parents and sharing times with children. And yet, as parents and as, you know, people that are really being role models for the younger generation, are you a shining example of what's possible and inspiring? Or are you a glaring warning? And so it's really taking a moment and saying, what's magic about me? Who am I in this world? Beyond our positions, our possessions, and our power, who am I really showing up as? And the only way you'll really get there is by pausing and reflecting on that question.
I got another magic moment.
Okay.
I will never forget this. I think the movie was Some Came Running with Frank Sinatra, Dean Martin, and I think it was Shelley Winters, I think. Frank Sinatra was in love with some woman who was some social whatever. And Shelley Winters, she worked at a bra factory, right? And they had met, and she was absolutely in love with him. And when he knew he couldn't be with the other one at that moment, he spent time with Shelley Winters. Now, here's where the magic moment came in. I'm sitting there watching the movie. He is sitting in a chair. He's a writer, and he's reading to her. And she is sitting on the floor, leaning up against the chair, listening to him. And he stopped, and he looked at her, and he said, What am I reading about? And she looked at him and said, I don't know. She said, then why are you listening? And she said, because it's you reading. It was a magic
moment.
That's
right.
Yeah.
It is.
Totally.
And we have those all the time. I mean, really just pausing. My magical moment is when my son was in the championship basketball game at high school. And, you know, this was after decades of taking him to practice and showing up for games and having him run up after and say, oh, did you see me play? And they won, and it was everybody was cheering. The fans were going crazy. And he's in his huddle, and he walks out of the huddle and walks across the court. And he's walking towards me, and I'm thinking, my chest is puffed out a little bit. I'm standing a little prouder. I'm a proud mom. My son is coming over to thank me for all that I've done his entire life. So he walks up. He walks up the bleachers, and I'm standing proud, and I'm running this story in my head about what a great son he is. And he walks right past me to his teenage girlfriend, wraps his arms around her, and they're cheering and laughing, and he turns around and he says, oh, hi, Mom. Thanks for coming. Thanks for coming. I'm the mom. I took you to practices. And I had a tear in one eye and a smile in the other, realizing that my boy had grown up. And there was a last time that he would come to me and share that. And as parents, we so want our kids to get to the next level, but we miss the last times they crawled, the last times they reached their arm up to hold you, the last time we tucked them into bed. Do you ever really know when the last time is that they say, come kiss me goodnight?
No, you don't.
You never know. You never know. And if you're stuck on your computer, you'll miss it. You'll miss it.
Ten seconds away, the world can change. Wouldn't it be great if everybody could live their life based on tonight at midnight it was over? What a difference it would make.
Well, we'd suck the magic out of the day, wouldn't we? We would appreciate and experience every moment. We would live that
moment. One thing, we're just about out of time, but one thing I want to add to it here with people. If you want to know what you want to be like, bring yourself out about 15, 20 years from now and have a dinner where they're honoring you and write down what you want everybody to say about you. Now you got 15 or 20 years to become it.
Right, and ask who do you have to be right now to have them say that in 20 years? Who do you need to be and what do you need to do right now? What magic is there for you to live
absolutely.
Right now?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
Pay each one of them $2,000.
Yeah. Well,
okay, Gina, let me ask you.
Sure.
Yeah, a website we can find you at.
Sure, GinaKloes, GinaKloes.com.
Okay, and we can get the book there?
You can get the book there. You can get the book on Amazon, What's Your Magical Moment? Yes.
Wonderful.
Your Pathway to Joy. Yeah.
Yeah, and Gina, if anybody missed it, it's up on our website, so we're good to go there. I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you so much, too, and thank you for sharing your magical moments. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care. Bye-bye.
Be well. Bye-bye.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Arthea Charlie Reed with us, the co-author of Financial Services, Women at the Top, a Women in Financial Services research study. She's a senior financial representative with Northwestern Mutual, senior partner at Long-Term Care Insurance Connection. She was formerly a professor and chair of the Education Department at the University of North Carolina. And she earned a doctorate at Florida State University and is a UNCA professor emeritus, and she divides her time between Asheville, North Carolina, and Hilton Head, South Carolina. And let's say, Charlie, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, when it really comes down to it, insurance business. And I'm going to give you a date, but you're supposed to forget the date as soon as I give it to you so nobody will remember, okay? In 1963, I went to work for Washington National Life Insurance on a debit, and those were the days you collected house-to-house 75 cents for health insurance. So I started at the bottom. So we don't do that anymore, but I kind of knew the insurance business from one angle.
Understand. I know a lot of people that were in that situation.
Oh, yeah. Now, by the way, what was the, when the two of you decided to write this book, what was the purpose for putting this to pen, Financial Services Women at the Top?
Well, there was the financial services industry is still largely dominated by males. It's one of the few professions that's primarily male. In fact, at least 80% and probably more. And that's changed very little in the last several decades. And what we wanted to do was we wanted to be able to give women the opportunity to talk about success that they've experienced, the success that they've had in the industry. And women have had a significant amount of success in the industry, but often the industry and the people in the industry and the leadership industry don't recognize that success. And so
but,
we have a.
But you're talking about financial industry. You're not. You're talking about financial industry, not like a male-dominated. You know. I'm sure, you know, when you get into administration, but not, you know, this is something that men can do and women can't. And what's the biggest challenge for women to cross that line to be able to be recognized in this industry?
That's a tricky answer. They're a tricky question. women are have indeed been very successful, and when the study that we did indicates that women have achieved as great as much as men have, but maybe at a different rate. One of the issues that women face in the industry, it's really not an issue for them, but it's an issue for the industry, is that most of the women in the industry are married, most of them have children. And what that means is, and they always put their children first. All the 23 women that we interviewed in this book, 100% of them that have children put their children before anything else. And so that means that in the years when they're having children and their children are young, they may not be as fully involved in the industry as their young male counterparts might be. And the people that are in the leadership of the industry might see that as being a negative. The women don't.
That's a good point.
The women recognize
that. No, I got that. Yeah, but that's a good point.
Yeah, and so that, but so what we see with these women is the women that we interviewed, their average length of tenure in the industry was 25 years. And they ranged in age from early 40s to late 60s, have incomes, most of them have incomes at least of $500,000 a year, several of them $1 million or more a year. And these women have been incredibly successful, but they may not have gotten to the level of success where they currently are as quickly as some of their male counterparts might have, but they also didn't plateau. They kept growing, and they're continuing to grow.
Is that the same thing today? Is it, I know 20, 25 years ago, there were some major hurdles women had to get through, and there's no question about that. And there are still some today, and you know we know that. But is it as bad? It seems as though you've got the doors open in so many different areas for women, and I've seen men backing down now, you know, instead of staying real close with their feelings about a particular subject, they've been loosening up now. And, you know, the stuff with the war on women, the war on men, the war on this, the war on that, I think it's brought things to the fore where you could actually move through this stuff, go through the garbage, quote unquote, and get down to the reality of it and realize that a person is a person. I'm not real excited about Hillary Clinton. I'm not getting political with you. There's somewhere I'm going with this. And if she became president of the United States, she would then become president. My feeling about her at that point would be she would transcend being a woman and she would become the most powerful person in the world. And I really believe that that's what we have to look at. It's not gender. It's the strength. It's the ability of this person to function in the job they're in.
Absolutely. And women are, there's so many things about women that make them so wonderfully qualified for this profession. Now, the financial services profession is primarily a profession of advisors. And women are great relationship builders. They are usually good listeners. They are they're willing to work with people over a long period of time and try to determine what is in the best interest of those people. So they have so many attributes that make this such a fabulous profession for them. But there are also then these early years of the profession that there's and it's not just what the men in the industry or the leadership of the industry is doing, and that the doors are certainly wide open for women. There's no doubt about it. I think every company in the country is recruiting women. But one of the problems that women face when they come into the industry is, you know, since the 1990s, when an act that was called the Glass-Steagall Act, which is the act that sort of combined all the various financial services organizations. It's no more banks do banking and investment firms do investments and insurance firms do insurance. Now everybody is doing all of it. So this is an incredibly difficult learning curve when people enter the industry. And one of the things about women, one of the things studies have shown about women consumers, and it's also true of all women, is that women want to have complete knowledge of something before they make recommendations, before they give advice, before they sell products, and to have complete knowledge of something that's really going to take a lifetime to learn all of the things that they need to learn is incredibly difficult, and that's a real challenge for women. That's not anything that anybody does to them. That's what they bring to the table.
Sure, and I think one of the biggest problems that we have in whatever industry we're talking about today, financial industry, whatever, between men and women, it's communication. I think that in and of itself is one of the worst problems that are out there. And it's not lack of communication, it's misunderstood communication. Because I say something, does it necessarily mean you're going to hear it in the way that I mean it? And I think there, that in and of itself is a problem. And if it's an all-men company, you got the same thing. So realistically, communication needs to be taught. It's a skill in all the different businesses that they're out there. I'll give you a fast example. I've done this time and again. I walked into a business, and the CEO, CFO, whomever, I said, okay, your immediate subordinate, whatever manager that was, write down what you think their job is. And they write it down. Then I go out to the manager and say, write down what you think your job is. And the manager writes it down. And then I go back in and we put it together. It's never the same. And I think that's one of the major problems that we have with women in the workforce. It's not the women not communicating. It's that balance of communication between both. There's judgments and all of those things that come into play, that those hidden fears that if you could just move through them, life would be a lot easier.
Yeah, and one of the things that's so interesting, I think, about the 23 women that we featured in the book is that all of these women are team players. They have large numbers of people who are on their teams, and they call them teams. They typically don't call them employees, team members rather than employees. And they're men and women. They're certainly not primarily women. They're men and women, and they're professionals. But what's really interesting to me is they've put together these phenomenal teams, but most of these really successful women have also moved out of their corporate offices or their agencies into offices of their own.
Yeah.
To me, that's kind of an interesting phenomenon. They've moved, you know, they've put together their own teams separately from what they potentially might have had in their agencies.
Yeah, let me give you a different word for a team, okay? How about family?
Okay.
And that's really what it comes down to. If you're acknowledged and you're accepted and you're part of what goes on, that's basically a family, and there's where the power is. There's where you, quote-unquote, make your money, get the job done, and everybody's coordinated.
Very true. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And women talk a lot about the importance in their lives of putting together villages. And it's the village that's in the office. That's their team in the office. But it's just as important for them to have a village at home, and maybe in some cases even more important. Because these are women that work very long hours. They have husbands, and they have children, and they have parents. And they are very involved with their families and are very concerned about their families, and it's critically important that they have a team that's working for them at home so that they can feel confident that everything that needs to be done there is being cared for while they're in the office.
Oh, absolutely. I can't tell you how many times I'll play around with somebody who's either a manager or somebody in a restaurant or whatever, where everybody goes to that woman and she's the one who basically tells everybody what to do, not in a commanding way, but just she's the go-to. And I've said time and again, I know what your position around here is. And I said, what? He said, Mom. And they crack up because it's true.
Right. Absolutely. Well, I think one of the
yeah.
women talks about how, you know, we really can't think about our lives as juggling or our lives as balancing, because those are two dangerous things. It's too easy to drop the ball. It's too easy to fall off the balance beam. So we've got to think about our lives as blending. And she makes the point of, I am always a mom. If I'm sitting in my office, I am still a mom. And if I'm at home talking to my child about lunch money, I am still a financial planner. I am both, and I cannot separate one from the other, and I've got to blend those things together. And I think that's really
bad. Yeah, and the other thing to take into consideration when we're dealing with this is, especially in the financial industry, it's the difference in definition of what money is. You know, it could be different between the men and women in a particular organization, which means they're not going to always be on track. So back to communication, back to definition.
Right. And one of the things about women, I think, that they talk about with us, we also learned in the survey, is that they're happy with different amounts of money in terms of income at different times in their lives. So that in those years when they are raising their children and they're incredibly active in their children's life, all these women came into this industry because they really wanted to be flexible in their time and be able to spend time with their families. So during those years, they're often happier with less of an income than their male counterparts might be, or than the leadership, who is probably male, of that office might be. But as time goes on, that changes. And they continue to grow those business and continue to nurture their family in the office and their family of clients. And it's true, their clients are their families as well, and their families at home.
Yeah, it's like not getting political, but Carly Fiorina. I'd work for her. I love what I've seen in her so far. She was a secretary, worked her way up to, you know, the a CEO of a major company, Hewlett Packard. And you don't just do that. And it's not. And there's a tremendous amount of men that couldn't do that. So you've got these people, you know, men or women, and there are women out there with this very special talent. And it's called take advantage of it for business, you know, for whatever, the organizations and so on and so forth. It's called don't stuff it down, you know, just take advantage of it. Use everything that there is. Because I'm quite confident that if you have a woman that's got those particular talents, if she feels comfortable and safe is a good word, she'll just open up with it, and there's a tremendous amount to learn.
Yeah, and what the women talk about safety, the women talk about their environments and how important their environment is to them. And that's one of the things they talk about. They talk about how they want their clients to feel comfortable. They want their clients to feel safe when they come to their office. And they're not talking about safety in terms of being afraid that somebody might be come in and do something awful while being there. They're talking about
emotionally safe.
They're confident, right. They feel like they can talk about the kinds of things they need to talk about, that there's nobody else that's listening, that, you know, that they are able to say the things that concern them, that keep them awake at night. And a lot of these women have actually created office space where they have workspace for their clients when they come in. So as one of the women said to us in the interview, she said, you know, I don't believe in cubbies. I don't like those office cubbies. I never wanted to be in one. I hated it when I was in one, and I don't want to put anybody in one. But we actually have cubbies in our office, but our cubbies are for our clients so that when they come in, they can work privately, they can work on computers, they can go look at their investment information, and at the same time, they can feel like they can get work done while they're waiting.
And very important, their consumers, their customers, are treated like human beings. I think we've lost that in the workplace. You know, we've gotten to a point where, you know, it's associate number 437.6. Walk into a market today, and they turn around, look at you, say, "How are you?" And they're not even looking at you. You know, and so I think because of technology, it's that human experience that, you know, women can bring to the workplace. The mom, the allowing somebody to feel that they're accepted for who they are.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And what's clear about these women, it's these women that are making such substantial incomes, it's still that their children are still first. And their clients are first when it comes to their business. That's what it's about. They recognize that. They not only know them all by name, not by number, but they know the names of their dogs and their kids and their grandchildren. And they've been people who have been part of their lives for years and people who they know probably more about than anybody else in the members of their own family.
Yeah, but what you just said is mom at home and mom at the job.
Mom at home and mom at the job. In many ways, that's true.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know what? Why not? We miss that. There's something that's happened over the last 10, 12 years or so where it's not there anymore. You know, you go to talk to somebody and they stare at you. I can't tell you how many times I've said hi to somebody walking across a lot or whatever, and they just look at you. You know, and it's just like enough already. So it causes you to back off. And that has to have an effect on business. And when somebody feels safe, that doesn't happen. I think really it's this word judgment. People are so frightened of that word that they don't give their all.
Yep. Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think another thing that I think is amazing about women is I think women are we've had to be very, very good time managers and very good organizers. We're not only dealing with the organization of our own lives, we're dealing with the organization of our children's lives. And in the case of those of us that have been in business that have a team or a village or a family in our offices with us, We're dealing with their lives and the organization of their lives as well. And women do that incredibly well. And
sure.
I don't like the concept of multitasking. I don't really think that we really multitask as much as that we are able to just to blend things together and to be able to do things very efficiently.
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. Now, is there a website we can find you at and also find the book?
Yes. It's WIFS National. WIFS is the company or is the organization that sponsors the book. So it's WIFSnational.org. And you can get to the book by going /WIFS-book.
Okay, and by the way, if anybody missed it, it's up on our website right now, so they can come and get it here. And by the way, one last question is there a question I should have asked you that I didn't that would have brought information up that we, the audience, need to hear? The subject matter is critically important.
Oh, my goodness, that's a tough question. I wish I'd thought of that one before you asked it. There's so many things that are interesting about these women. We were talking about the earlier about Hewlett Packard and Carly Fiorina. They did a study a few years ago, a number of years ago, about women and men and their willingness to accept promotions. And one of the things they found in that study is that men only needed to feel 60% confident and that their ability to do that job if they were willing to take the promotion. Women needed to feel 100% confident.
Makes sense.
Do
you remember, we're really running out of time, but do you remember the old Peter principle?
Oh, absolutely.
It works like
this.
Oh, yeah. That's what you just talked about. You get a great salesperson, and they're wonderful at what they do. They move them up because they're really good. They become a manager, and they're an okay manager, great salesperson. Then they move them up once more because they've been there, and they're a lousy manager, or they're a lousy executive, an okay manager, and it's that height of incompetency. And if you don't have 100% knowing what you're going to do and how it's going to come out, you got a problem. So I think that's really what we're dealing with. Okay. And by the way, thank you. I got the engineer yelling at us. So I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
And thank you for your time. Appreciate it very much.
Oh, take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Alan McDougall with us, the author of Breaking Through, Discovering the Riches Within. Alan was a longtime miner in Northern Ontario who skillfully tells the powerful story of his personal self-destructive path into alcohol and to the abuse in his book, Breaking Through, Discovering the Riches Within. Alan now inspires audiences to evaluate whether or not their loved ones are following similar self-destructive habits and motivates people to take the actions required to change lives for the better. Known for his visionary and strategic leadership, Alan also facilitates educational programs nationally and internationally and implements and conducts accredited courses Alan is a powerful speaker and a trainer and a member of Les Brown's Elite Platinum Speaking Network, as well as Toastmasters International. He integrates proven strategies into personalized programs, and his real-life experiences, that's where it came from, energy and captivating style influence, motivate, educate, and inspire audiences. Alan, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. That introduction really brought back where I came from 20-some years ago, and I'm living a life, as you said, totally beyond my belief 28 years ago. So thank you for reminding me.
Oh, Alan, let me ask you this. Where did the light bulb go on for you that said, I've got this problem. I need to, it's enough. I'm done with this, and I want to step into a new path. What happened? Where was it?
Well, I think it was like a dimmer switch, if you're going to use that light coming on. It was really a dimmer switch. I knew 4 years before I quit that I had a problem, but every time I knew I had a problem, I would go back out drinking to forget that problem. And on June, if that makes any sense, and then
sure.
On June the 2nd, 1987, I was sitting in a bar and drinking my whiskey and Pepsi. I'd lost my family, and I was living in flop houses and et cetera, et cetera. And I was drinking whiskey and Pepsi and taking a drink, and then my body would refuse to accept it. And most people that would have one or two drinks and had the vile response that I did in the bathroom would give it up for the day. And I continued that scenario for 5 consecutive hours. So my brain was telling me to drink, and my body was saying, I can't take it anymore. And that was the day of decision-making.
Now, by the way, where did you go to be able to leave it behind? What were the steps you took?
The steps I took was my first step was to make a decision. Do I buy a gun and commit suicide? Do I continue drinking and end up in an institution probably? Or do I stop the drinking? So I chose to try to stop the drinking, and I went to the United Steelworkers Union, where I was a member as a minor, and I went into their office. Had an in-house employee assistance program, and I told them my exact words were, I've been told I may have a drinking concern. And that was the beginning.
Okay, how did they deal with that? Because that's going to be an interesting response from them.
Yeah, well, I always was a bit of a minimizer with my problems, so it kind of fit into my thinking. However, In that office, that the company that I worked for paid their wages, and they were recovering alcoholics, and the union paid their office expenses and to drive people like myself to AA meetings in my case and rehab, if that was the decision, they knew because they had lived it. They were sober 5 or 10 years, so they had lived it. So the response was a very welcoming response. A very welcoming response. It's the only place I could go that I thought I could trust someone at that point.
That makes sense. That makes sense. Now, in Breaking Through, you talk about a psychic shift. That's what it was that allowed you to go through the addiction. What was that, and what brought you to yours?
Well, the psychic shift, I think, and there's so many variations of that, but the psychic shift was, if I can say this, is I came from self-centeredness to other-centered, or from childish to childlike. And it was a process of not only thinking about me, but thinking about others. And that was a big shift for me, because I was always thinking about my addiction. See, when you have someone like myself that had an addictive personality or a problem, I was always told all my life till the age of 37 I was a problem. I was a problem, but then I discovered I'm a person with a problem. So when you can separate the two, you love the person, hate the problem, and work with the problem, there is the start of a psychic change.
Okay, that makes sense. And then obviously we're talking about the idea that you could manage something, and I think that's got to be the first step. Now, there's a time between AA and going to rehab. I think, what was it, a month for you? Why was that good for you?
Well, I think it's good for everybody, and I can only speak about my own experiences, of course. But it was good for me because it gave me 30 days of being off the alcohol, which was a record for me, total record. I was off there for 30 days, which gave my, and I went to 30 meetings in 30 days, one meeting every day, and I learned a little bit, finally, and it gave me a chance for my brain to get kind of unclogged. So when I did go into rehab, which I didn't do well, I mean, I went through it and I was great for after it, but it gave me a chance to clear my mind and to learn a little bit about the program. And that's one thing I talk about today at length is we are a society of instant gratification. Or
sure.
Instant, and so when we as a union or a company just take somebody off for drug testing and put them into rehab the next day, I firmly believe with all my heart that's a recipe for failure.
Yeah, it doesn't give the person a chance to really make the decision that this is what they want to do.
Right, and that's why I do a lot of research into this and reading, of course, because it is one of my passions. And I hear so many people coming out of rehab second or third time and then making the ultimate sacrifice by killing themselves. And I that's just my own opinion, but it
sure.
happens so often there has to be something there.
Yeah, but you walk your walk. I mean, obviously you've been through this. Now, I've never had an alcoholic problem, but I smoked for 20, 30 years. And if anybody's out there that smoked and tried to quit, you know, that's an addiction. I mean, it's not as bad as alcohol, but at the same time, it's almost impossible to quit. And it's that satisfaction. And what we're really dealing with is different chemical changes in the mind. And when you get something where you feel that you're doing the right thing and you're on the right path, you get those chemicals going that make you feel good, and it takes the place of the alcohol, not overnight, but over a period of time.
Exactly. And I smoked heavy, of course. I smoked two and a half packs a day. And,
oh, yeah.
And there was no moderation in me. See, I never drank for pleasure. I totally drank all my life for effect. So the reason mm-hmm. I quit smoking cold turkey without any patches or all that stuff, they weren't there back then. I wanted an insurance or a cushion in my life. If something had happened to my three children that I couldn't handle, I would not go back to drinking. I would
sure.
choose to go back smoking. So that was the lesser of two evils in my mind. So that's the reason I quit as an insurance plan.
Yeah, these kids today don't get it when they're smoking. When I was a kid, cigarettes were 18 cents a pack. They're $6-7
mm-hmm.
a pack now. That's a lot of money.
It certainly is. And go ahead.
You smoke 2-3 packs a day and then multiply it out by 30 days. You're talking a few bucks.
Absolutely. I never knew. I was never able to save money and didn't know why. And didn't know why until I figured out my budget for drinking back in the mid-80s.
Oh,
man. It was $300 a week for drinking.
Wow. You know, when you come down to it, there's a lot of kids out there today, a lot of social pressure, a lot of, you know, PC, you know, and the sensitivity,
yeah.
and no matter what, if you breathe, you're doing the wrong thing. You're a homophobe, you're sexist, you're racist, you're something. And it causes people not to want to express freely, which causes them to bring it inside. That, in and of itself, could be a good reason to start drinking.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. I just wanted to feel like I belonged. See, I never thought I belonged in my family. I never thought I belonged in my school. I was bullied and everything else, and that's another story for another time. But when I got into, there's two things made me feel welcome. The union that I worked with and the miners, because we trusted each other every day 4,000 feet underground with our lives, and I felt like I belonged. But I also felt like I belonged when I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I detested myself for being there, but I felt somewhat like I belonged. And that's an important part of life.
Yeah, I had a friend years ago who had gone through AA, and he said it was the best thing that ever happened to him. Not necessarily in the beginning, but what he got out of it. And it seems as though, and I have no idea why, we seem to have to crash. We seem to have to hit bottom before we do anything about ourselves. And the majority of the people that go to AA have hit bottom. You know, that's it. There's no more choices here, except if you want to off yourself. And I think that in and of itself is a great starting point for everybody, because you've got people who have been there, they've done that. This didn't come out of a book. This is people who have had the addictions that can allow, they can work with people, and they know what they're talking about. I think that's so critically important. It's the support system that probably got you through it.
Absolutely, and if I may take 10 seconds and tell you about the importance of my first meeting. I went to my first meeting. I didn't want to be there. The union gentleman said, you know, I think it's time to go to an AA meeting, and I was working all those years. I kept my job, believe it or not, and I said, I'm working afternoon shift, always thinking that AA meetings were at night, and I always had plan B, and I said, man, I'm on top again. And then he said, there's one at noon, and my bottom fell out of my life. I said, I'll meet you there, with no intention of going. And then he said, and I asked where it was out of respect for him. He told me it was in a bar where a restaurant closed for lunch, and there was AA meeting. So that's what got me to my first meeting. But the importance of the first meeting was this. There were people in there that didn't know me. They welcomed me in the door. And as I was in that room having a bowl of soup, because that's all I could hold, it was hard for me to feed myself because my head was shaking so bad, was this one man stood up and said, hi, everyone. My name is Mike, and I'm an alcoholic. And the next 10 or 15 words that he said gave me my first hope in my life in 37 years. And this is what he said. If I continue in the next 2 weeks not to drink, I will have 4 years of continued sobriety. And I figuratively took those words out of the air with my fist and put them into my heart. And that's the magic of the power of the spoken word.
Oh, very much so. Very much so. And I think if we have alcoholism, drugs, whatever the case may be, whatever kind of an addiction there is, most people hide it. And what I'm hearing is that the minute he stood up and he said, you know, I'm an alcoholic, he brought it out to the open. And everybody in the room acknowledged him for it. It wasn't something they judged him for.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Yeah.
But it's kind of funny because when I was drinking, I was very public. Everybody knew I had a drinking problem much more than I did. I knew I did, but didn't want to admit it. So I was very public. But when I went to my AA meetings, we were very secretive about, so it's kind of ironic. We didn't want to give our last name, and I see the value of that. And we were in church basements or VFWs or whatever was good enough to donate us a room, but we were very secretive. So when you look at it, after I had a few years of sobriety, I said, here I am living my problem very public, and when I try to better myself, I'm very secretive. Always amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, and when it comes down to it, it's really not acknowledging who we are, why we are, and who we're blaming, because the world, I probably say this 50,000 times a day, 10 days a week, that the world is nothing more than a mirror. And you go out into that world and you prove yourself right about yourself. So you get into messes, you pull the people in who will acknowledge that you're not worth it and so on and so forth until you do that mind shift. And that's where most people have problems, because they're blaming somebody else, but it's really coming from within. They're drawing those people to prove to themselves that they're not worth it.
Exactly. And my upbringing, there's a quote that my mentor Les Brown told me, don't let someone else's opinion of yours become your reality. And that's what I did. I was told all my life I would never amount to anything. So at the age of 37, I could go home to my parents and say, hey, thank you, I'm here, I've arrived.
Yeah.
So I was a product of what I was told all my life.
And the people who say it, and I realize it was your parents, but the people who say it are the ones who never made anything out of themselves. And what they do is they project it onto you. Yeah.
Yeah.
And too bad as a kid we don't know those things.
Yeah, well, the one reason I wrote the book, there's lots of reasons I wrote the book, but I didn't write it for 25 years after my sobriety, because I knew I had to live a life of value after I quit the drinking to write a book of value. And my purpose of the book was 50% income and 50% impact to help others. That was the reason I wrote it. And it's a book of redemption. It's a book about life. It's a timeless book because there's a lot of other topics in the book besides the drinking. It's not a book of drinking as much as a book of life and overcoming adversity.
Sure. Let's change the number, okay?
Yeah.
It's 100% income and 100% helping people.
Okay. I can
hear it.
That.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. If you had a book that had 100% guaranteed cure for cancer and nobody mm-hmm. bought it, it wouldn't do anybody any good. So
that's
your
right.
job is to get the book in the hands of that audience out there, and you can't in 20 minutes or half hour, 45 minutes, whatever the time an interview is, give the audience what the book can. So it's 100-100.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Thank you.
All
new
the way across
the for Alan.
Good. Okay. Good. Okay, we're just about running. We're just about running out of time. So let me ask you this:
Yes.
Is there is there something that this audience needs to hear that we didn't talk about yet?
There's something the audience needs to hear we haven't talked about. Is love the person, hate the disease. The other one is how. How do I help someone? Or how do I overcome my own addiction? Or how? I got caught up in that word how so often I could hardly live with it. My sponsor, Jim, said in great anger finally and frustration with me, he said, let's sit down and let's break up that word how. And he did, and I've lived by that ever since. And the H is for the honesty to ask for help and to say
wonderful.
That you're in trouble. And the O is for openness to new ideas because my best thinking got me sleeping in ditches. And the W is for the willingness to try it on a daily basis. I'd like that audience to remember that.
No, absolutely. Okay. Website we can find the book at.
www.ampublicspeaking.com. And for a time, it's on sale. It's a discounted price. It's also in Barnes & Noble, on Amazon, Nook, Kindle. Anywhere you can get a book, it's on there. It's just amazing. I got so many emails back and letters from people that said the book helped them, so I realized that finally I've lived a life of value.
Oh, absolutely. Somebody up there said we're going to have to take you through this so you can do what you were said here to do.
Absolutely.
Got it. Okay.
I'm a success in spite of myself.
Oh, and I hear you loud and clear. Breaking through, discovering the riches within. Alan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for so much as well. You have a good day.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye. Bye-bye.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Glenn Aaron with us, the author of Observer, the Ronnie Lee and Jackie Bancroft Spencer Morgan story, a state of people, greed, envy, manipulation, and how about even some crime. Glenn served his law and business clients with distinction for four decades. He's a retired attorney. He's an author. He's a businessman. And he became knowledgeable in asset protection, helping numerous clients preserve their assets. The retired Aaron writes fiction thrillers and nonfiction books, notably the Prison Trilogy. He's at work on a book on how to protect assets through offshore banking. Book 2 and 3 of the trilogy will be available in late. That's a couple of years ago. We got to get you up here. Glenn, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it, Michael.
Okay. And by the way, when we really come down to it, we talk about financial services. It's obviously about, you know, a couple. What was it that caused you to put this particular story to pen?
Well, it was my last two clients. Jackie Bancroft was the Wall Street Journal heiress. And she married her interior decorator, who was also my client. I often wondered, I still often wonder, how many lawyers can remember or identify who their last client was. Most of my colleagues can't even remember. For me, it was quite a path, the last two clients. I represented Jackie for the last 5 years of her life until her mysterious death. My representation of them got me a ticket to the federal pen for 2 years for money laundering because primarily when Jackie married Ron, she wanted to be able to give him money and leave him money. But I had him in bankruptcy. He owed over $2 million in judgments. So she couldn't do that directly. I set up a blind trust offshore, so she could. However, she was fine with that. She funded that with $40 million over 5 years. But when she died, of course, the heirs, both near and far, came after the money and me along with it, and ultimately the court found me guilty of bankruptcy fraud for setting up that blind trust.
Oh boy, Glenn, how did she end up with so much money?
Well, as I say, she was the heir to the Wall Street Journal. Bancroft, her first husband, owned the Wall Street Journal. And when he died, well, he left her one of the wealthiest women in the nation. And believe it or not, she lived in the mountains of New Mexico, Ruidoso, beautiful area, and spent her whole life there. But lived well, I might say. And
yeah,
then,
Go ahead. Oh, I was going to say, there, an interesting point, because what comes up next is she's going to marry this guy, her 50-year-old gay interior decorator. So, and then
yes,
she's going to give him $40 million. Okay, so there's got to be something behind that.
Well, yeah, for Jackie was 72. So, New Mexico, a $23 million performing arts theater that's absolutely fabulous. She paid $23 million cash for it. I came onto the scene while she was finishing that, and Ron Morgan, her interior decorator, was the decorator on that theater. And she was putting $6 million worth of Chihuly glass in that theater. I had to negotiate with Chihuly about prices and mistakes and all of that sort of thing. And I was, of course, hugely shocked when she told me, you know, I'm going to marry Ron. I want the last fling of my life, and I don't want it to be alone. Now, I guess it was a generational thing about marriage. Why she couldn't have just taken Ron along, I don't know. But indeed, it was quite a fling for that last 5 years.
Now, by the way, all of a sudden, Jackie's death was mysterious. I mean, when she died, she didn't just die naturally, did she?
Well, no, I don't think it was natural. The way that happened was they would take these world cruises for the elite. The cost of the cruise would be about $100,000 a month, and they were usually 4 or 5 month cruises. So they were on one of those cruises, and she became sick. I got a call about 3 o'clock in the morning from the boat, from the ship, wanting to know what they should do. Well, it was news to me, and she was in the middle of the Atlantic, almost impossible to get her off of that ship very, very quickly. As I began to learn what the nature of her problem was, it was a stomach problem and a blockage. They had been in port only 3 days before, and she was sick then. Ron could have easily gotten her good medical attention while they were in port. In the middle of the Atlantic, it was impossible. There wasn't even a doctor on the ship. There was only a nurse. Anyway, it was my duty to get her off that ship and back to the hospital in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which I did, and that's all in the book. But she lived about another week and then passed away.
Do you think she was poisoned?
So, well, what I know is that with proper attention, she'd still be alive. She didn't get proper attention. So whether it's nonfeasance or malfeasance, I don't have the evidence to say, but it certainly raises the eyebrow.
Now, she and Ron got divorced, right?
No. No, she died and left him.
Oh.
He got her will changed. His great desire was to become an heir of the Wall Street Journal. And through another lawyer, and unbeknownst to me, he got her will changed to where he was an heir upon her death. Of course, that all came to light to me for the first time when I got sued by the heirs, saying that I'd placed undue influence upon her, which I hadn't, but that was neither here nor there. Anyway, it's a fascinating story, Michael, and I don't think most lawyers could, most of my friends in civil law couldn't remember their last corporation they represented, but I took a bit of a different path.
Glenn, let me ask you this. I pick up the book. I read it page by page, cover to cover. I don't put it down. I really get into it. What's my takeaway? What do you want to tell the audience? What's that certain essence of the book that you want to make sure people get?
Well, I think what people get from it is the greed of the elite. I mean, I suppose all of us have a bit of greed in us, but, I mean, this is absolutely unbelievable, and it's more of a show of what occurs in people's life than it is a moral judgment. I don't preach. I simply tell the story, and the takeaway is the moral interpretation that the reader can exact upon the script.
Okay, so realistically, money, money, money. You know, I think there's a problem out there with people defining what money is, you know, in corporations and so on and so forth. And if you have money, you're evil, yada, yada, which is all garbage. You know, it's not money. It's not money that's the problem. It's the love of money and taking advantage of somebody because of it. There's where the problem is. But, you know, she had to be worth, what, huh? Go ahead.
Oh, hundreds of millions of dollars. But and you just described Ron Morgan, Michael, when you made that statement. As for Jackie, she was really a very nice person. We played a lot of golf together. I liked her very much. And she wasn't greedy. She had no reason to be greedy.
Right.
But even before she became one of the wealthiest women, she wasn't greedy then. I mean, she was quite individualistic. And she did a lot of good contributions to charity.
Well, what was your purpose in marrying Ron?
Well, all Jackie ever told me was she wanted to travel the world. She wanted to see things that she had not seen, go to places she had not been, have her last fling. I think her picture of her last fling was travel and seeing. The face of the book, I took those pictures of each of them and put them on the face of the book. Actually, I extracted those pictures. They're standing in front of the Taj Mahal, and they sent me that picture. But that's how I got that. Ron, he simply was after money. I mean, sociopathically.
Yeah. But let's go back to your 2 years in prison.
Yeah.
How'd that change your life when you got out?
I don't know that it changed my life. I have a very dedicated and wife and family. Mm-hmm. They supported me the whole way. I do notice the effect that I don't like to be in crowds anymore. I get claustrophobic, and I was in a cell with my cellmate. That's a little larger than the restroom for 13 months. So, I think it did have that effect on me. But other than that, my friends have stood behind me. Lawyers have. The judges have. So I don't feel injured too much.
Good. And thank goodness it was only 2 years.
Yeah. Yeah, isn't that the truth? Because I was looking at 20.
Oh, I bet you took a deep breath when they came down with the with what you were going to serve. But when you really come down to it, you do the blind trust and people do all what they do. How did they find that trust?
Well, that's another part of the story in the book. The Bancrofts actually bought a judge, a state judge up in Lubbock. He declared that trust, which I had admitted to, because it wasn't illegal at the time. I admitted to through discovery, but then he declared the trust ab initio, which means no good from day one. There was no way to really do that legally. But once he had done that, I knew that I was in a position of bankruptcy fraud. I went straight to the Attorney General, to the Attorney General's office, federal Attorney General, and says, look, I got a problem. Here's what it is. So they brought in the FBI and investigated it all, and I was supposed to get probation. But then they called me 2 weeks before coming in to plead and said, Glenn, we see that you've probably done this for a lot of people. And you wouldn't have known how if you hadn't been doing it for a long time. We want to know everybody that you ever set up blind trust offshore for. I said, no, that's not happening. I don't give up people. I just never have, and I'm not going to.
But how could you legally do that being an attorney?
I know. Frankly, I couldn't.
No.
There wouldn't be any way that I could. It violates that very premise. So anyway, they said, well, you're going to do some time. I said, well, thanks for telling me. I'll go tell my family.
Yeah. Was it a little scary when you went in?
Oh, hell. I've seen them before. Yeah, you bet it was. I don't care how many times you've represented people or been in to visit them in a prison. When you go yourself, you hear that clank. It's not a good feeling.
By the way, I heard that clank once. I was in jail. I was in the state penitentiary for 2 days. I would make it quickly. The radio station I was at, there was also a cab company in the radio station. And two of the cab drivers murdered the guy who owned the cab company, and they found, you know, they caught the guys down at the airport with money and blood all over them and whatever. Yep. And he said, because I knew him, he'd come in for advertising. And he called up and he said, something's wrong here. He said, did you have a psychic on the show? I shouldn't be here. And I said, how are you calling me? Why, you know, I said, you just got called, didn't you? And he said, yeah, but we get one call. I said, great. So I called the chief of police, who I knew, who called the warden, and I said, I want to go to jail for 2 days. I want to see what this is like.
Oh, my God. You're a brave soul, buddy. You're a brave soul. Yeah. Well, you know what it's like, then, and it's not a place you like being. The idea that they're country club prisons for white-collar offenders, there may be, but I never saw one. Hello.